Okay, so I'll now introduce our speaker. That's April. April has been is a member of Socialist Alternative. She's an activist out at Sydney University, has been for a number of years involved in education campaigning, and also recently the victorious marriage equality campaign. And so she'll be speaking for however long, and afterwards we'll have time for discussion and so on. But if you could please now put your hands together and make April welcome.
So obviously, if you turn on the news pretty much any day of the week, you often just get a flood of absolute horrific things happening all around the world, whether it's the atrocities in Syria and Yemen, the climate disasters that wreak havoc on poor island nations, or sandpapered cricket balls in South Africa. There's a lot horrible going on in the world. But in all seriousness, it's really only human to see those images and want to abolish it immediately. How do we just transform things as quickly as possible so that people don't have to live in such absolute misery as exists all around the world? And so this kind of sentiment of something must be done is a very powerful kind of statement, because it's true. Something has to be done about the horrific state of the world. But something must be done, I think, is the catch cry of a lot of organisations and institutions with extremely sinister motives, extremely terrible motives, as well as a well-meaning but ultimately kind of counterproductive organisations that want to do something about the world but adjust themselves to the way the world's already structured. The aid that's administered to developing countries by governments and multilateral organisations like the UN and by charities, if you're looking at those things on the screen, it can be a bit of a relief to think there's money going over there, it's happening, there is money, we're sending it there, we're doing something. Or you can think, that's what I want to do, it's a drawing card to get out there when you want to change things, you want to be a part of the aid industry. But I want to argue that, actually, this talk's called When Humanitarianism Becomes Imperialism. I actually think there's very few times, actually, when the overarching humanitarian ideology hasn't been really a kind of cover and a justification for imperialism. The whole human concept of human rights, the fact this metaphysical existence of human rights does not actually influence the world in and of itself. Just because human rights violations are happening, that is a fact of the real world, but you can't change it just by saying, hey, we're supposed to have human rights. These are a metaphysical concept, and unfortunately the world does not operate according to the principle of human rights. It operates according to the principle of material power and material interests. And so you cannot morally persuade people in power to do the right thing unless it serves them. And ultimately, if it serves them, then it doesn't serve the rest of us. So the question is, are there things that institutions with material power do that actually do anything for human rights? And I think absolutely not at all. We're asking as well, you might have criticisms of the aid that is currently administered, and you might ask, can we reform the system of aid? You might see big holes and big problems with it. Is there a way to reform the current way that aid is given from states, governments, and from organisations to the poor countries? That will actually solve it. And I think more fundamentally, there's a deep question of, can we end disaster and war? Can we stop these disasters from happening within the framework of capitalism? And so that really depends. Your answer really depends on how you understand capitalist society, whether it's reformable, whether it's, you can persuade it to do the right thing. But we don't think that. Marxists argue the core of capitalism is about making profit. And a minority control the means of producing everything we need, and it has an interest always in utilising that power to make more profit for itself. So these capitalists hold the working class to ransom. They exploit our labour by giving us no choice but to work for them. And the secret to getting more profits is to have profits in the first place. So only the most effective exploiters are going to survive this intense and ruthless competitive system. So production and society at large become organised solely around the motive of the minority of this class, whose interest is to exploit the rest of us. But as capitalism expands, the scale of its competition also expands. And so capitalists need not just material wealth, they need armed might to protect their profits from other capitalists and their own working class. And this is kind of what we describe as the imperialist nature of the system, that the competition at the heart of profit-making takes place on a global level between governments and states as they try to take as much territory, etc., as they can. So the competition leads to an incredible arms race around the world. And this is what Russian revolutionaries, Vladimir Lenin and Nikolai Bukharin, pointed out 100 years ago when they were debating people who are arguing that the fact that the world is getting more global means the world's getting more peaceful. There would be an interest in states and governments not to go to war with each other and not to kind of screw everything up, because ultimately it's better for capitalism and profits to have a peaceful, stable society. But their argument is that doesn't matter. If in the ideal there would be better for things to remain peaceful, the fact is that competition and that conflict is constantly asserting itself. And there are plenty of times when a ruling class thinks going to war and expanding its military is absolutely what it needs to do to defend itself. And I talk about this first. I talk about this imperialist system because unless you understand it in those terms, it's really hard to get to the core of what's wrong with the concept of aid, let alone the reality of it, which is worse. And so you have to think of aid as having to adjust itself at the very best, and playing a assisting role at worst with the imperialist system of competition, domination, exploitation. And obviously, as I said before, this is utilised, governed by class interests, not by moral principles of anyone in power. There's no one in power in the world who believes in human rights. No one. Unless they believe in them as a useful prop or as a useful ideological thing. But there's no one in the world with power who would stop what they think they need to do because, oh, we might violate some human rights. That is not how the world works, unfortunately. And this also, this thing, this problem of wealthy people or wealthy governments handing money over, flinging money to poor countries to look good, and the kind of limitations of that kind of charity were really well summed up by Engels long, long time ago. Marx's political partner, who was denouncing at the time some of the super wealthy in Britain and America who were starting to become philanthropists and start the, Rockefeller Foundation and these kinds of things. It's just such a great quote. He said, "The English capitalist class is charitable out of self-interest. It gives nothing outright, but regards its gifts as a business matter, makes a bargain with the poor. It says, if I spend this much upon benevolent institutions, I thereby purchase the right not to be troubled any further. And you are bound thereby to stay in your dusky holes and not to irritate my tender nerves by exposing your misery. You shall despair as before, but you shall despair unseen. This I purchase with my prescription of £20 for the infirmary. It is infamous, this charity of a Christian capitalist, as though they rendered the workers a service in first sucking out their very lifeblood and then placing themselves before the world as mighty benefactors of humanity when they give back to the plundered victims the hundredth part of what belongs to them." I think this is the best way to frame aid, charity, giving, all of that stuff, is that why are they poor in the first place? Why is so much of the world incredibly poor in the first place? This is not just the historical question of imperialism and colonialism in those countries, although that is absolutely crucial. It's an ongoing, absolute draining of resources and wealth from the developing world, and you fling a hundredth part back to it and you say, "You're welcome." So this kind of cynical and self-interested role of foreign aid, I think if we go back to just after World War II and we look at the US Marshall Plan for Europe. Now, Europe obviously isn't a developing area, but this was a really one of the first kind of massive foreign aid projects, the idea of throwing lots of money into other countries. America poured billions into rebuilding industry and military power in Western Europe to keep it firmly in the American camp and prevent the USSR from gaining any influence. Even the Marshall Plan, though, didn't actually really contribute that much to the growth of the European economies, and that its main function was to kind of implant American companies on the continent for reconstruction and for arms trade, and to influence European governments to massively marketize and liberalize their economies. And all the research, the people who kind of summarize the results of the Marshall Plan see that that's the key kind of result, was that while European governments weren't the victim of this aid, clearly it didn't actually assist the ordinary people in the way that it did the American imperial interests. But by 1961, the Americans had diversified their approach of foreign aid, and this is very much as it starts to become kind of what we know it as today, as giving money to the poor countries. And so in 1961, they established USAID, which focused on Latin America. But all throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there were revolutionary movements going, tearing through the continent of South America, and these absolutely terrified the Americans, who up until then had a large number of kind of dictators in the area who were puppets for them and did their bidding, like in Cuba or Bolivia, etc. And so hundreds of millions of dollars of aid really was about going to these repressive dictatorships, propping them up, trying to prevent revolutionary movements, radical movements from taking control, from nationalizing industries away from American influence on the continent. The most notorious example being Chile. And so in 1973, America helped to orchestrate a military coup in Chile that led to the murder of 30,000 leftists. And 10 years later, USAID, looking at Chile, described General Pinochet as bold and persevering in his pioneering slash-and-burn neoliberalism. And the privatizations that that Pinochet did gave American companies much more opportunity to profit from the continent's wealth. And they justified aid to Chile in these terms, quote, "A modest amount of assistance rendered by USAID in Chile not only will pay special dividends there, but it can be useful for privatizations elsewhere in the world." So foreign aid was also deployed at this time to vie for influence in the Middle East, which was a contested space with the USSR. And there was very much a carrot and stick approach. As a country did what the US wanted, the aid would go up. And when it did not what the US wanted, the aid went down. For example, in the 70s, as America had growing influence over Egypt with Anwar Sadat, they were able to export massive amounts of food to Egypt, which actually destroyed the local agriculture and then made Egypt dependent on further US imports. And then that requires loans. You've got to take out loans to buy that food. And then actually at the end of the 70s, the Americans deliberately spiked up the interest rate all around the world of their dollar, and that created even more dependence of all the countries that at that moment had debts. So this was a very deliberate thing. And of course, during the Cold War, the USSR did a similar thing, albeit with a much smaller radius of influence. So money spent in Eastern Europe or other small communist states, so-called, Cuba, had the same goal, which was to advance the interests of empire, to kind of get more out of it than you put in, and that kind of thing. But by the 1990s, America had emerged obviously triumphant, and there was one kind of undisputed superpower with global reach. So maybe there would be no war anymore. Well, unfortunately, that was proven wrong very quickly with the Gulf War and with a number of other imperial wars of the 1990s. Because the capitalist quest for profit doesn't end ever. Even if you don't have a kind of a rival in the world that can equal you, you want to always continue to find opportunities to project your influence, to implant your military power, and you think about all the bases that the US government has established all around the world. That's very much part of the so-called aid program. And now an interesting new kind of ideology of this aid and of America's role in the world kind of emerged, because the ideology of the Cold War, obviously, was that communists were coming to kill you and steal your toothbrush. So that's why you had to spend so much on the military. You had to send so many people to go die and let countries burn, because otherwise people would die and countries would burn. And so without that bogeyman, a new ideology to justify US imperialism kind of needed to develop. And I think the new narrative kind of goes like this. What makes the US and the West superior, and in fact what kind of meant it won in the end, is its liberal capitalist system that respects the rule of law, human rights, and individual freedoms. It explains its position at the top of the global system and has allowed it to establish a peaceful and lawful world order that allows every country to aspire to the Western ideal. However, many people in the world live under despotism, and it's the West's duty to free them by intervening to create institutions that ensure the rule of law. In some ways, this is not a new idea. This ideology of the civilising mission of imperialism goes back a long, long way. You just have to look at Rudyard Kipling's poem in 1899, The White Man's Burden. Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed. Go bind your sons to exile to serve your captive's need. To wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new court sullen peoples, half devil and half child. But this time, rather than the kind of enterprising civilizers venturing out into the hinterlands, or the clash of world systems like World War II or Cold War, this time there's one international order. And it's comprised of impartial and multinational institutions that apparently arbitrate and intervene in global affairs. The massive expansion in the 90s of institutions like the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, really helped to reinforce the illusion of kind of collaboration and universality and general agreement across the world about how the system should run. But the American and Western institutions are kind of seen to be interchangeable with the multinational ones because really they're the ones that adhere to the rule of law. And the idea is that the world now is fundamentally peaceful and stable, but there are kind of these upsets and disruptions in the fabric of society with, you know, human rights violations over here and over there that need to be ironed out and fixed up. And so this is really, I think, the concept of human rights as this abstract universal that some countries adhere to and some countries don't. This is kind of the new ideology of, you know, kind of imperial supremacy. This is why we should be meddling with everyone in the world. And so a series of interventions in the 1990s in Somalia, Iraq, Rwanda and the Balkans were justified on the basis of human rights abuses occurring there. The interventions were more than ever run under the umbrella of the UN, and these were conflicts agreed to by, you know, multiple stakeholders and governments, and not just America, as it, you know, that was the look. And this blunted the edge, I think, for those who are quite still very suspicious of Uncle Sam because of the Vietnam War, because of a lot of other conflicts. And so the idea that it was this consensus amongst various powers, assuaded some of those people's suspicions. So they were looking for a cleaner look. The other thing is that, media really saturated these disaster zones. And I think America had really learned from the Vietnam War that, televising the conflict had its problems because of the brutality. So the media of war reporting became much more controlled, much more tightly authorised. You had to have your UN media pass and all this kind of stuff. So in the 90s, you'd see footage all the time of the crates floating down, of the blue UN, beautiful soldiers, benign blue hats. You'd see the horrible atrocities by whatever dictator or whoever that you're trying to overcome, but you wouldn't see, obviously, the atrocious crimes of the occupiers. And so the idea is something has to be done, and it's now being done as gently as possible. But the results were really disastrous in every case, which discredited the UN amongst the population of those areas. People in these areas do not trust the UN whatsoever. For example, hundreds of thousands of Somalians and Iraqis starved to death thanks to the sanctions on food supply that were imposed by the UN and co. The Hutu-Tutsi tensions had been deliberately inflamed in Rwanda, and the UN, the aid which came was in the form of ceasefire monitors and peacekeepers instead of food, which is what people actually need. When you look at the intervention into the Balkans, a lot of the powers were playing off each other, picking one side and then another, and it really actually extended the horrible sectarian conflict there for a much longer time. Not to mention a really sadistic human trafficking ring that was organised in Bosnia by UN officials who were there as officials of the anti-human trafficking. That was their job, to be against human trafficking, and they had extremely sadistic human trafficking themselves. There's a movie about it, and the movie, the woman who exposed it, who was in the UN, was then sacked, and they took it to court and did everything they could to discredit her. They then made a movie about it, and she said, we had to tone it down by about 10 levels because, you know, it would be so absolutely unbelievable confronting to see what these UN officials had done. They had to tone the movie down. And so that's part of this. Now, America obviously ran with this again and had, after 9/11, again, they want to try and rehabilitate their image alone as, upholding human rights and these kind of things. So then Saddam Hussein had WMDs and biological weapons. and Afghanistan treated women terribly. We have to go and fix all these things. But hopefully we're all aware of the utter disaster that has occurred in Afghanistan and Iraq thanks to the invasion and occupation of the United States and its allies, including Australia. And so, there, you know, as was mentioned on opening night, the estimation is about 2 million people have been killed as a result of the war on terror. So that is humanitarianism for you. But the thing is, humanitarianism doesn't really need these actual results to kind of to sustain itself as a comforting ideology, because you just it just needs a really horrible moral outrage somewhere to show you and to say, you've got to, you know, even though we fucked up every other one, look, there's another one. You have to do something about this one. So that urgency, that sense of if you don't support intervention, you support what's going on there, and this kind of ideology, that can stick even if the actual material results of humanitarianism are nothing. And so we kind of have an underlying assumption of humanitarianism here, which is that to some degree, some governments in the world really believe in human rights and some don't. And I just think that's not true, because we have to first look at the concrete reality of foreign aid in the world today. The first thing to say is that foreign aid remains overwhelmingly military aid. Imperialism is the world policy, because as I said, it's the capitalist competition for profits at the global level. Might makes right, power is material, outcomes are determined by who has the ability to compel the other, not governed by values like respect for human rights or democracy. Military might, the ability to kill and destroy on a massive scale, is an absolute essential if a group of capitalists want to protect and advance their interests. So America's top five biggest foreign aid expenditures, not foreign military aid expenditures, we're just talking about the broad umbrella of foreign aid now, everything that comes under the umbrella. The top five biggest foreign aid expenditures of America are annually are $3.8 billion to Israel, that well-known developing country, $4 billion to both Iraq and Afghanistan, $1.6 billion to Egypt, and $1 billion to Jordan. Those are the highest expenditures. And that's a third of the whole budget of foreign aid just there, the aid they give to those four countries. All of this money comes under the umbrella of security assistance, and so it's deliberately and explicitly meant this is not about humanitarian assistance, this is security assistance. That's even what they call it. And it's pretty obvious how this serves US imperialism. Like, Israel is a nuclear-armed watchdog for America in the Middle East. It's occupying Iraq and Afghanistan and has to maintain those, which costs a lot of money. And Egypt and Jordan border Israel. When you read government aid budgets, you won't be able to avoid the word governance. It's always there that most of the money is for governance, effective governance, is the term used in the Australian budget. Not even good governance, just effective governance. And this is obviously code for bolstered security forces to repress and control the population. So if we look at Australia, far and away Australia's largest recipient of aid is Papua New Guinea. DFAT, the Department of Foreign Affairs, reports that 80% of the money we spend on Papua New Guinea, and it's by far the biggest expenditure for us, is spent on effective governance, which means the permanent presence of Australian Federal Police in Port Moresby, its training of PNG police, and helping to shield the compliant PNG government from corruption charges. Just a couple of years ago in Papua New Guinea, there was a big student movement to demand that Peter O'Neill, the Prime Minister, who's corrupt up to his eyeballs, actually step down, and the PNG police shot and killed a number of students, and Australia had nothing to say about this because they approve of it. And not to mention the hundreds of millions that Australia spends on PNG's Manus Island to lock up, you know, hundreds of refugees and torture them. None of this money actually goes to the Papua New Guineans, who are amongst the poorest people in the entire world, despite them being the largest recipient of Australian aid. Australia's next largest payment is $141 million to the Solomon Islands, where Australia has maintained a police occupation since 2003. Like, Australia's police are the police of the Solomon Islands. They also took over a number of government departments in the Solomon Islands since 2003. In 2006, these police tear-gassed locals as they protested after elections. They were accusing the Australian forces of vote rigging. And there was supposed to be a scheduled end of this mission. It's called Ramsey. So now it's just been replaced with a new program that's the same to support police development delivered by the AFP. So sticking around. And one aspect of foreign aid, which is deliberately not included in the umbrella of foreign aid because it would then blow the ratio of military to assistance even further out, would be to look at arms deals. Arms deals every year are equal to the entire aid budget of every country. So for every dollar that's spent in the world, supposedly, to help people, and remember that we've already looked at probably half of that aid budget we've just looked at is military, then we get the arms deals. For every dollar of this, half of which, remember, is for the military, for every dollar of that, a dollar is spent selling guns to someone. So we're already pretty unimpressed. America's record arms sales last year to Israel, Saudi Arabia, Australia, and Europe was twice its foreign aid contribution. And as I said, that contribution itself is also majority military. All right, okay, yeah, sure, we're not for that. But what about the rest of the money? There's still some money there. Isn't there merit in the non-military component of the money? Well, far and away, the next bit, we've taken half out, the next bit we've got, far and away, most of that is categorised as economic development, infrastructure, and trade. And the phrase kind of invokes images of building up schools and hospitals and housing and workplaces and dams and power plants and cities so that countries can transition to developed, prosperous, stable capitalist economies. And if that were true, you could still kind of argue that capitalism, you know, that still can serve the long-term interests of capitalism. There's still something in it for those countries. But actually, even that is not true. There is no real economic development of the developing world in the sense that aid does that. The divide between rich and poor countries, for example, is wider than ever, despite decades of so-called aid and assistance. The colonial origins of the wealth of the West is evident in the fact that today more money flows out of Africa each year than into it. $40 billion more flows out than into it. So actually, as people have kind of ironically said before, Africa is aiding the developed world and not the other way around. And in fact, across the entire developing world, a comprehensive 2012 study by Americans and Norwegian researchers reported that for every dollar of aid received in the developing world, they lose $24 in net outflows. So most of what comes under this umbrella are loans to the developing world. The World Bank and IMF get huge portions of foreign aid budgets. So if you look at Australia's foreign aid budget, you have a whole section that's going to the Pacific to control those countries. Then you have money that gets given to multilateral organisations, and those two are about equal. And a whole bunch of this money is going to go to institutions like the World Bank, the UN, and the IMF. So the aid budget includes giving money to people giving out these loans. So after, you know, nations of Africa liberated themselves from colonial powers after World War II, their economies were deliberately ravaged by the former colonial occupiers, and put them in a position where basically they had no choice, or felt they had no choice, but to take the loans offered from them by the IMF. But money kept flowing out of the countries, obviously. The debts became larger, requiring additional loans, and then the only way you can pay those off is to sell off the state assets, guess who to, and scrap food and fuel subsidies for the population to cover those debts. And so this just ends up utterly impoverishing the population. Strings attached is putting it mildly. Australia's aid budget actually deliberately boasts about a 20% target of 20% aid for trade target. So that is that 20 cents in every dollar of aid that that Australia gives is for getting the country to buy and sell with Australia. So there's 20% of aid where we think the strings should be really visible, and 80% where the strings are a little less visible. There's actual infrastructure. There is some infrastructure built in these countries too, like ports, oil fields, power plants, roads, railways, dams. But these are not built for the general use of the population. They're used for massive mining corporations or docks and these kinds of things that are just kind of put on the country. And it doesn't mean all the money is flowing into the country. You just need to build something there to make a profit. And so, you build all these roads, but they're not roads for people to use. They're roads in and out of the mine to wherever you, to the wharf, from the mine to the wharf and back. That's all, a lot of this infrastructure is. So part of Australia's aid to PNG is the sum that we've both agreed to spend on a liquid natural gas plant, which Australian companies profit from. So we said, oh, it's only fair, you put a dollar in, we put a dollar in, and we own the company. The profits, another example, the profits that Australia earns from oil in the seas around East Timor. So after Australia occupied East Timor in 1999, by the time they left, they said, well, we should get everything, basically. You're a tiny little shithole country, and we should have all the territory around your island, all the resources that exist under the sea. So every year, Australia makes more profit in oil from the seas around East Timor than the country's own GDP. And ownership, as I said, was acquired through sheer bullying. So debt and actual investments in the country complement each other. So China, for example, another kind of increasing player in foreign aid, gave a loan to Sri Lanka to build the Hambantota port, and then the debt from that loan became so large that they had to give the port over to China to own for 99 years. And the same for a Pakistani port in Gwadar. And China also has, massive investments in mines and oil fields in Ghana, Nigeria, Sudan and Zimbabwe. But they're by no means the only bad guys in this, despite the kind of current chatter from Michaela Akash about, Chinese foreign aid being used for ulterior motives. Well, that's the case for everyone who's doing it. Now, there kind of has to be something in it for the host country to accept this infrastructure, construction and those kinds of things. But it's something in it for the capitalist class of that country, not for the population of that country. So the capitalist class will think, oh, we'll get a fraction of the revenue from this thing, we'll have a steady revenue for the state, and we'll have to care even less about the population and what's happening with them. An interesting fact, the Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak, from 1982 until he was overthrown, he misappropriated 87% of all aid to Egypt. And everyone's probably heard of that foul phenomenon of like luxury cars going through the streets of really poor African cities. Well, you can thank foreign aid for that. And obviously a lot of it is just an excuse to throw money at big business directly in one of those countries. So part of Australia's budget is $50 million a year on innovation exchange, which, quote, partners with the private sector to modernise aid programs. And in this innovation exchange, on the board, Julie Bishop appointed the climate change denier Bjorn Lomberg. And the other thing is that Australia counts in its program of aid, quote, to increase the supply of seasonal workers from Pacific Island countries. So Australia considers the fact that if you've seen the reports, people from islands around Australia, Fiji, Solomon Islands, etc., Tonga, will come here, will be absolutely exploited on farm picking, fruit picking farms and this kind of thing, to a level that has been, compared with blackbirding and the actual slave system that used to happen. They consider that aid, that those people come here and get exploited. That's part of the aid budget of Australia. It's ridiculous. All right, so the military's out. The trade bit's out, okay, they're no good, sure, fine. But what about that bit that's left? There's still a bit left. That's for assisting people in terrible disasters or crisis zones. Isn't that what we come to mean by aid? Isn't that bit any good? Well, the first thing to say is just how stupendously wasteful they are with this tiny remaining fraction of foreign aid. For example, in Yemen, the US Department of Defense spent $300 million on a project to build schools in a province that supposedly had al-Qaeda activity. They began in 2007, and by 2010, the first school remained unfinished. The people of Puerto Rico, if you've seen the horrible hurricane that hit them not long ago, they've been given absolutely nothing. They were promised huge amounts of food aid, and all they've got is a foul president lobbying paper towels at them. If you saw that, that's what they got. They got Donald Trump come to their country and throw paper towels at them. You're welcome. Money is easily siphoned off by layers of middlemen, and a lot of it finds its way back to the military purposes in the first place. There was an Oxfam study in the mid-2000s that said half of all the aid that goes to Afghanistan, that's not the military part, ends up just being used by the military anyway. And a general research on the effectiveness of charity and aid in general suggests that in the resource transfer from rich countries to poor beneficiaries, only about 19 cents on the dollar gets to those recipients, and 8 cents on the dollar gets to recipients from sub-Saharan countries. So for every dollar you're giving, 8 cents of it is getting to someone in a sub-Saharan country. And plenty of NGOs and charities, all right, so governments, they're nasty, they're evil, we get that. Plenty of charities, private charities, don't just have ineffectual methods, they're quite sinister. And I think an excellent example is the Gates Foundation. Now, people hopefully are a bit sus about this guy because he's one of the richest people on the planet, but you might think, oh, isn't it better than nothing? He's giving a lot of the money back, you know, it'd be better than just keeping it all. But it's really a lot worse than you think. The Gates Foundation is its own corporation. It's got a third of the World Health Organization's budget goes to the Gates Foundation, and it works extremely closely with massive pharmaceutical companies. And so it has these campaigns to vaccinate the whole world from something or whatever, or to provide every woman in Africa with certain contraceptives. These are the plans and goals of the Gates Foundation. Sounds very fine. But the vaccines and medicines they're using, they pick them because they haven't yet passed tests and the standards, the stricter standards of Western medical trials. So actually these are pharmaceutical companies trying to use their vaccines or whatever. Obviously vaccines are fine, but you need to test them first. And they're being tested on children in Africa to this extent. In 2010, the Gates Foundation funded a trial of an experimental malaria vaccine. And the trial resulted in 151 deaths and caused serious adverse effects, including paralysis and seizures in 1,048 of the 6,000 children who were vaccinated. In Chad, reports alleged that 50 of 500 children forcibly vaccinated for meningitis later developed paralysis. This apparent concern with developing world health is not benevolent or new. Even in the 19th century, there were schools of tropical medicine established by the US in places like the Philippines because they wanted to increase the productivity of the labourers they had there and also ensuring the safety of the white overseers who were there. Another really interesting point about this global health angle of aid, which I find very compelling in one of the articles I read, is how the global health angle is now infected with all the same language of security and stability and the war on terror. And a quote here, that, you know, save the world from every disease kind of saviour complex of health has really turned into an issue of global security. So the quote, the developing world is portrayed as a teeming petri dish of SARS, AIDS and tropical infections spreading disease and death across the globe and requiring Western powers to establish centralised health systems designed to overcome the constraints of state sovereignty. That's really important. These things like the Gates Foundation replace an actual public, state-sponsored and state-provided public health care system in these countries. All right, we're running over time, but we've got to look at Haiti, obviously, because this is, you know, the most damning indictment, I think, of where your money goes and what it helps. Haiti has more NGOs per square mile than any other country in the world. So you'd think it should be going pretty good. Things should be looking up. Things should be improving. The standard of living should be going up. The more NGOs, the more standard of living, all that kind of stuff. Obviously, this is garbage. Haiti's been occupied by the US forever and ever. In the mid-2000s, it became a permanent UN peacekeeping mission, and they barred the popular president from returning for his own safety, and they engaged in direct repression of the Haitian people. So in the last 10 years on Haiti, the UN has killed more than 20,000 people. And one UN soldier from Brazil said, the truth is that not a day passes where the UN troops don't kill a Haitian in an exchange of fire. Now, nothing the UN, the US, or the NGOs did, nothing they did for 6 years at least, could prevent an earthquake that killed 250,000 Haitians, one of the worst natural disasters in history. Nothing they did could have apparently prevented this. And then the UN sent in more aid, and this aid included soldiers with cholera, who killed another 10,000 people by spreading cholera across the country. They put military soldiers and troops around the border of the country and in the seas of the country to stop people fleeing to America. The society was shut down completely so that Bill and Hillary Clinton could come and show themselves, oh, we care so much about all of this. And they actually had forces pushing the poor people out of the way, making sure they weren't in the shops. You couldn't see how bad things really were. After this, There was so much destitution in Haiti that they had to... people were deforesting massively. They were cutting things down for fuel, cutting the forest down. And then that meant that the most recent hurricane that also hit Haiti was even more devastating than it had to be. So this cycle is absolutely outrageous. And I think the donors in a lot of this couldn't really give a shit because Haiti remains what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a tax haven, supposed to be a luxury resort, it's supposed to be a plantation, and it's supposed to be a sweatshop. And so from their point of view, the AIDS worked because that's still that. Not to mention the new revelations people may have seen a few months ago that Oxfam, you know, a nice, non-governmental, often writes very good stuff, seems well-meaning, they were running a sex slavery ring in Haiti that went all the way to the top. The most important official of Oxfam in Haiti was implicated. But there's another kind of general crucial problem with humanitarian assistance, even when it's actually effective. Because, of course, some of the money is going to help someone, you know. Hasn't anyone ever been helped by the aid? Of course. Of course there are situations in which, you know, without that aid, the difference for someone could mean further destitution or even death or starvation or help. So, of course, some dollars of the aid help some people, but at what cost? It has to come with all the strings attached. It comes with the vast portion of the aid for military destructive purposes, and they throw in the crumbs, the hundredth part of what they steal, and say thank you very much. And so that's one problem. The other is that instead of demanding that states around the world provide for people, there's this expectation that unaccountable, undemocratic private organisations can come to your country and decide how they will distribute services. And no doubt this is what led to the sex slavery ring in Haiti, because people are desperate, they have no access to anything, the only way they can get things is to go and beg to NGOs, please give me this thing. The NGOs have to work in cooperation with the military and the UN forces, that's how they get their money, that's how they get their headquarters, that's how they get the interactions. And so they have to follow their lead. They're not going to follow the lead of the communities who say, we want this, this, and this. We want to be self-reliant. We want to be able to do these things. They say, no, because our ties are with these people. Then they start to see the community as kind of at loggerheads with them. They can actually start to be afraid of the community. They can start to rely on the military occupation and forces there to defend the NGO from the people they're supposed to serve. This creates a sense of tension and hostility between the providers and the others. And just generally, it turns what should be about a movement of overcoming imperialism and poverty into a 9-to-5 job for people to get a salary in a country where most people can't get a salary. And you might have impressive community leaders, impressive activists in that community, and they're desperate for work, so they join the NGO. And by then, they're kind of sucked out of their community, that, you know, they're the kind of radicalism and the activity that they could be doing is siphoned away. All right, well, I've definitely gone over time, but, like, so obviously we can admit that some of the money from some of it goes to some people and helps them some of the time, but actually almost all the money doesn't. And to have this system at all of supposedly giving money is about the imperialist system we live in. So it's never going to be the case that the aid given goes against the imperialist interests of the country giving it. They're never going to do that. And the imperialist system is the reason why so many people around the world live in wars, in disaster zones, you know, are refugees, are destroyed, are poor. And so we're saying it's worth it for the hundredth part that you might get from the aid. It's not. And so we have to conceive of a different way of thinking about aid. Now, obviously, there's been talk because of Donald Trump and all of these fuckers about, oh, why do we have to give all the money to the shithole countries? That's obviously, you know, we have to attack and defend the idea of assisting other countries from this, you know, nativist, nationalist filth. But in general, most governments and the mainstream love aid because it does actually serve a purpose. It helps to tie those countries to them, make them dependent, clear out alternative methods of gaining those needs. And obviously, the military aspect is the dominant aspect of foreign aid, and you have to remember that. So I think what we should be about is not so much aid, even though definitely much more money should be going to these countries, and we can demand that, but it's still going to be a trick. How do we actually make sure that money goes and helps people? Because if we continue to live in the capitalist system and we rely on them to administer it, it's not going to. That's why the resistance to the capitalist system is the best thing you can do to aid people around the whole world, because that's what they're doing to aid themselves. You think about maritime workers in Australia and around the world when they refuse to ship things like iron and things they know are going to be turned into guns and bullets to attack other people around the world, when they boycott Israel or South Africa, and those kind of things. That's the best way you can give your international solidarity and aid people around the world. You think about the Arab Spring, the way all around the world people were looking at it and thinking, wow, this is incredible, people can overturn things. And inside the Arab Spring, people were looking out to other struggles and thinking, wow, even there they're doing it. And so that interplay is a much more useful thing for your time. And Palestinian liberation, this is a crucial question. It's one of the linchpins of world imperialism. It's better to stand up in our own country against what's happening in Palestine and against our own government's support for Israel than it is to send some money over there. Really, it is better. And also freedom for refugees. Refugees is going to become, and is already, one of the biggest international issues in the world. The best thing you can do is to fight against our own government, who says you'll be locked up and tortured. It's better to do that than to send some of your money to a refugee who might or might not get it. It's better to do that. And also, we're heading towards an era, possibly, of war, further war in the Middle East or in Asia, and we need to stand against that. Because no matter how much money you contribute, there's always a whole lot more money to make the world a much worse place. Our strength aren't our dollars. Our strength is our numbers. Our strength is our social power. Our strength is our obvious solidarity and collective interests. And that should be the way we conceive of how we're going to help people around the world, not by allowing governments, states, unaccountable organisations taking our money and hoping for the best. Thanks.